Good afternoon. We'd like to get started on time because we only have an hour and everyone has to rush back to work. So my name's Robin Wiltshire and I'm the co-chair of the Campus Community Committee. I have to take a deep breath before I say that. I'd like to encourage all of you to go to our website, which is campuscommunity at mcgill.ca/campuscommunity, to learn more about the work that we're doing. We circulated an evaluation form today, and in addition to an evaluation of the session, we'd like to know your ideas for future speakers and who we might invite, what you'd be interested in hearing about. On behalf of the committee, I'm very pleased to welcome all of you, and it's so nice to see so many familiar faces of faculty and staff and colleagues. I'm pleased to welcome you to our second in the Lunch and Learn series. As you know, we have others coming up, and to extend a very warm welcome to Dr. Stephen Grover. I had the pleasure of attending Dr. Grover's talk that he gave on the heart at MiniMed. It was my introduction to McGill's Minis. It was a great talk, and I was thrilled when he agreed to present in our Lunch and Learn series and to join us today, so I thank you, Dr. Grover. I was going to go into, he has broad research interests, and he's been recognized for his work and won many awards, and I was going to go into great detail, and he told me to can it, that he really wants to talk. He wants to leave time for questions and answers at the end. So we'll just move right ahead to that. Dr. Grover's clinical interests include the importance of exercise and weight reduction in the to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity. And that's really the topic of his talk today. As I said, there'll be time for questions at the end, but we won't waste any more time, and we'll get on to gambling with a heart-healthy lifestyle, where should you place your bets? Dr. Stephen Grover.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be down here on lower campus. As you must realize, I spend most of my time at the McGill teaching hospitals. I usually find myself talking about this sort of topic with colleagues and medical students, nursing staff, but come down to lower campus is a real pleasure, and thank you very much for inviting me today, Ron. There's really a couple of titles for this talk. Everybody can hear me okay. I've got a bit of a laryngitis, but it's carrying all right. A couple of titles for this talk. One is gambling with heart-healthy lifestyles, but I guess really at the end of the day what we're really most interested in is what can we do to improve quality of life, prevent disease, and increase longevity. I'm going to show you today there actually are a couple of things you can do. I mean, the scientific evidence is clear. It's unequivocal. I think the real challenge for most of us is figuring out what the science has proven, what the science has disproven, and where there's just a whole lot of confusion with really no good evidence one way or the other. The list of things that you can do on a regular basis, the list of things that you'll read about on a regular basis just goes on and on. Folate intake and the risk of hypertension, homocysteine as a predictive factor for hip fractures, homocysteine, folate, and vitamin B12, and mild cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's disease, and vascular dementia. Vitamin D in the instance of multiple sclerosis, dairy foods, calcium, colorectal cancer, a pooled analysis, and last but not least, it's always coffee. Coffee consumption, the risk of type 2 diabetes among middle-aged Finnish men and women. Now, you realize this isn't even the popular press. I'm not looking here at Business Week or Time Magazine. These are medical journals that are publishing this stuff. If the scientific community is still undecided about these things, you can imagine how confusing the message is by the time it works its way down to the popular press. I think the end result from all this confusion is we get a certain amount of pushback ultimately. People say, you know, the doctors, the scientists keep changing their story every week. Why should I believe any of this? And before not too long, one can come across things like this. This is the heart attack grill. Out in the Midwest of the United States, home of the double bypass burger. This is their heart attack grill menu. They have single, double, triple, and quadruple bypass burger, flatliner fries, deep fried and pure lard, Jolt Cola, and no filter cigarettes. Now, I'll be quite frank with you. If you look at this list on their menu, you'd say, oh, this is all poison. The fact of the matter is it actually isn't. Other than the cigarettes, cigarettes are real poison. If you can, I'm going to touch on cigarettes. I'm going to just say one thing. If you're a smoker and you can stop smoking, you have a good chance of adding somewhere between 3 and 5 years to your life expectancy. It takes about 4 years for a smoker to develop the cardiac risk of a non-smoker, And it takes probably 10 or 15 years for your cancer risk to go back down to that of a non-smoker. But if you're smoking cigarettes, you're probably knocking somewhere between 3 and 5 years off your life expectancy, and that's on average. Not to mention the quality of life issues if you develop emphysema, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, et cetera, et cetera. So other than the cigarettes, I don't actually think any of this stuff is poison. In fact, if you look at it, all served up with the French fries on the side. I mean, if you can eat something that size, I think then we have a problem. But the ingredients themselves, quite frankly, are not so bad. This is the problem. You know, you eat a couple of these things, and to me, the real issue is, can you eat this stuff and not end up looking like these guys? And if the answer is no, well, then that's the problem with these foods. I don't really care much about what you eat, as long as your weight's under control and you exercise regularly. As much as we'd love to believe there's a magical cure out there from either low saturated fat foods or antioxidant vitamins or more fatty fish or whatever, I'm not going to go into a lot of the data on that. I'm going to touch on it very briefly at the end, but unfortunately, I have to tell you, in my opinion, the data is very disappointing. I don't see any miracle cures on the horizon in terms of eating. If you want to think of something simple that we can all do, I would probably offer up the most important thing is eat more fruits and vegetables than you're probably doing at the moment. Not because I think they're particularly healthy foods, but they keep you away from the high-fat stuff. Excuse me. So what are my recommendations for optimal health? I've already told you, don't smoke. Maintain a reasonable weight. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Exercise regularly. We're going to spend a lot of time on that with you today. Pay no attention to any other recommendations. Nothing is going to make you more sick and more stressed out than fussing about all the crap you read in the popular press about this is going to extend your life, this is going to make you live forever, this will prevent Alzheimer's disease, etc., etc., etc. Why do we focus on those few things? No smoking, exercise regularly, try and keep your weight under control. Well, it's primarily about atherosclerosis. And the atherosclerotic process, as most of you know, is this buildup of plaque over time. And the things that cause this plaque to build up in your blood vessels are high blood pressure, high cholesterol, low good cholesterol, diabetes, cigarette smoking, being overweight, being sedentary. That's what this is about. I mean, if you can't get the blood supply to the vital organs of your body, you're in trouble. Whether it's your heart, when you end up with a heart attack, your brain, when you end up with a stroke, or tiny little strokes that you don't notice are even happening and probably are the major cause of dementia that we're seeing. Your kidneys, your legs, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all about circulation to your body, and that's why this cardiovascular business is so important, because the organs just can't survive without it. Why do I focus so much on exercise? Well, this is the prevalence of risk factors among Canadians. Diabetes is underestimated here, but it's probably closer to 4 or 5% of the adult population now. High blood pressure is probably underestimated as well. Cigarette smoking has been going down, but still approximately a quarter of our population smokes, which is absolute craziness. It's shameful that the government's in bed with the cigarette makers and getting tax money off of this sort of stuff. Being overweight, by the way, this is for people aged 20 to 59. If you look at the data for older people, there's even more overweight individuals as we get older. We just all gain weight normally, naturally, as part of the aging process. It's a real fight to keep your weight down, but it's a worthwhile one if you can succeed at it. And last but not least, physical activity. And physical activity here refers to people admitting, saying that they think they exercise 1 hour a week. Imagine that 55.5% of the population can't even lie to themselves that they exercise 1 hour a week. It gives you a sense of the sort of sedentary lifestyle we really have in our society. I like to focus on physical activity because everybody can exercise. There really, for most of us, are no barriers to learning to exercise and doing it. Whereas I'm not going to spend any time on weight today, it's easily a whole lecture, but losing weight is a major challenge. For those of you who are trying to do it and aren't succeeding, don't feel so bad. You're not alone. Weight, I just came from seeing over a dozen patients this morning over at the McGill Cardiovascular Health Improvement Program. And while they're all exercising, there's very few of them are losing weight. And they're going to nutritionists, they're exercising, they're doing everything right. It's really tough. That doesn't mean it's worth giving up. It isn't. I'm going to show you data on people who do lose weight and how their numbers improve so dramatically. But don't feel bad if you're having trouble losing weight. It really is a struggle, particularly keeping it off, I should add. You may say to yourself, well, why do I have to worry about lifestyle? There's all these drugs out there that will just take care of it. And they truly are magic pills, to be honest with you. This data is old. This is from 2004. We're probably spending closer to $2 billion now on cholesterol-lowering drugs in Canada, and we're closer to $4 billion now on antihypertensives. And there's no question these drugs work, and there's no question these drugs will reduce your risk of a heart attack or stroke, and they clearly have their place in modern medicine. What I find so frustrating, though, is approximately 50% of the people I see on a given day who are on these drugs didn't have to be on these drugs if they would just exercise 2-3 hours a week and lose 10 or 15 pounds. I'm not talking about them getting thin. I'm not talking about them getting to their ideal body weight. I'm just talking about losing 10 or 15 pounds and keeping it off. Even if you're on these drugs, this is a beautiful study out of Circulation from a couple of years ago, showing what happens when people follow a healthy lifestyle. What they looked here at was a low-risk lifestyle being the effective strategy to lower the risk of coronary heart disease, even among men already reducing their cardiovascular risk by taking antihypertensive and lipid-lowering drugs. We know that the drugs we're prescribing for people these days, you know, cholesterol-lowering drugs will reduce your risk of a heart attack 30 to 50%. Blood pressure pills will reduce your risk maybe 25%. And aspirin a day, approximately 25%. Just because you bring your risk down 25 to 30% doesn't mean you're not going to have this problem. There's still, if you look at the clinical trials, even the people who get the drugs, a substantial portion of them still go on to develop the heart attacks and strokes. What was so interesting about this study is they looked at beyond the medication, what happened if people followed a healthy lifestyle. By healthy, I mean they didn't smoke, they were physically active 30 minutes a day of moderate or vigorous activity, and moderate activity is a brisk walk. They had a good diet score. Diet score here is too complicated to explain to you, but basically it meant they took a look at how much fat they ate, how much fruits and vegetables they ate, how much fiber they ate, how many calories they were consuming per day, whether they were following the food guidelines, and gave them a score based on how healthy they thought their diet was. Moderate alcohol consumption, at least 5 grams a day, with an upper limit of 15 grams a day for women and 30 grams a day for men. So a little bit of alcohol, they're saying, was actually beneficial. An optimal weight, a BMI of under 25, which most of us can't get to in, during midlife, but these were the things they defined as being low risk. And look at what these data showed. For those individuals who couldn't attain one of the five, none of them, this is their baseline risk. If you got to just one of the five, did one of those five things right, you dropped your risk by about 50%. And for every additional lifestyle you added to what you were doing, for the people who did all five of them correctly, their risk was approximately 10% of the people who couldn't do any of them. 10%, a 90% reduction in cardiovascular events. That's huge. We don't have a treatment that does that, a medical treatment, a drug treatment. A 90% reduction is fantastic. And if you look at these data, these are the people who were on medication. These are the people who are not on medication. Excuse me, I'm going to cough again. These people who were on medication saw exactly the same benefit. So the medication, this is additive. A healthy lifestyle is additive to taking your drugs. What fits your busy schedule? Exercising 1 hour a day or being dead 24 hours a day? It's amazing. I don't mean to scare people. I mean, at the end of the day, we're human beings. We're not machines. There's a limit to what any of us can do. But we can all make minor, modest changes in our lifestyle that really will reduce your risk. And I'm not suggesting, even if you follow all five of those things, that you're going to live forever. You're not. That's just the nature of the human condition. But if you do any of these things, chances are you will extend your life expectancy, and you'll, more importantly, perhaps improve your quality of life during that time. Why do we have such a hard time sticking with exercise? Well, first, I think many of us don't really understand the risks and benefits. We really don't understand how very modest exercise has actually huge benefits. And I'm going to get into those. The costs of exercise are small, but there's still a cost. You have to get the equipment, you have to join a club, you have to figure out a way to do this on a regular basis. We don't get a lot of support. How many of us work in a work environment where there's a gym on site? Actually, McGill's quite unusual that way, but most people don't have, you know, going to the gym is something they have to do from home or do from going from work. We don't get a lot of feedback. We don't get feedback on how the exercise is reducing our risk. I'm going to show you some of the things we've been doing here at McGill over the years about that. And last but not least, the timelines. It takes a while. If you want to see these benefits in terms of weight reduction, blood pressure, cholesterol, lowering your sugar if you've got diabetes, as a general rule of thumb, you're looking at 3 to 6 months before you see things get better. We're very impatient by nature. Taking a drug and 1 month later seeing all your numbers improve is just so much easier. So motivation problems are common. You know, I mean, how do you drag yourself out in the morning when you just don't feel like doing it? Well, one of the most important things I'll tell you, that it's a very, very simple piece of advice, is get some help. Team up with somebody. You know, now ideally, don't team up with someone so you can get the hamburgers off the counter. Team up with somebody so that one of you is always dragging the other one out. There's nothing like a group of people who go out running or walking or meet at the gym or have a regular tennis date. There's nothing like working, you know, using the power of social networking, if you will, to try and keep yourself on track. The other thing is, I think you need feedback. And I think if you haven't been exercising for a while, I think you need to know how to do it properly to start with. Many of us can just get out there and start from scratch and be successful at it, but a lot of us can't. We have no idea how much exercise is enough. We have no idea what the right intensity is. We get out there, and the first 3 days, we completely overdo it. We're sore. We injure ourselves. That's it. We're finished for the next 3 months. We're not going to be exercising any longer because, frankly, it's just not possible. So this is where, you know, for many of you probably don't even know about this, but CHIP, or the McGill Cardiovascular Health Improvement Program, has been there now for 14 years. It's part of the McGill community. We see most of the cardiac patients. I mean, if cardiac patients are seen anywhere in the system, we see them at the rehab program. We see people with diabetes. We run a sports camp in the summer for obese teenagers. For those of you who are interested, by the way, I brought a few brochures as well as spinathon brochures for our spinathon, which is occurring next month, which raises the money for the obesity camp for the teenagers. And the key here is giving people the feedback and the tools they need to actually make some changes. Let me show you what a risk profile looks like. This actually does dovetail with the work that our research group has been doing now for the past 15 years at McGill, and that's disease simulation models. In other words, mathematical models that predict how a disease will unfold without actually waiting for it to happen. And you have to prove that these models work and prove that the predictions are accurate. I won't go into that today, but this is the end result of that, and this is a cardiovascular risk profile, where for someone whose blood lipids are a little bit elevated and their blood pressure is a little bit high and they smoke cigarettes and they're overweight, if you look at their underlying risk of developing a cardiovascular event in the next 8 years, it's about 11.5%, where it should be somewhere between 3 and 5% for a Canadian of that age. And if they bring their cholesterol down or bring their HDL cholesterol up or bring their blood pressure down or stop smoking, they can bring all those risks down. And if they do everything, they can get their risk down quite low. If they do nothing, for a 43-year-old, they have the risk profile of someone who's 50 and a half. In other words, they've lost 7 years off their life expectancy because all these numbers look so terrible. Remember, I told you cigarettes are good for 3 to 5 years right off the bat. If they do these things, however, they can bring their cardiovascular age down to that of a 42-year-old. Now, that's competitive for if you're 43. You want the heart and the blood vessels of someone who's younger, not someone who's older. So the first step is recognizing where you are at baseline. You know, where is the room for improvement? Where are you going to get the biggest bang for your buck? The next is tracking your progress over time. And nobody just goes down, 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 and stays down. We're all people, you know, and the human beings, human nature being what it is. You see some go down, and eventually they start to come up again. Patient comes into the office. You say, I don't understand why your risk profile has gone up. You know, there's subtle changes in your blood pressure, your lipids, your blood glucose. Why are things changing? The patient says, I don't understand it. I was doing everything you told me to, doctor. Give me another 3 months. They come back 3 months later. Everything's better again. You say, okay, so what happened in the last 3 months? And they admit to you, well, you know, I really wasn't exercising 4 times a week. I was sort of doing it once a week, and I wasn't doing my exercise for 40 minutes. I was doing it for 15 minutes. And, yeah, sure, I gained a little bit of weight because I wasn't really sticking with my eating plan any longer. And those little changes, while you may not see them in their blood pressure, their glucose, or their blood cholesterol alone, those little changes across all of those parameters really change their risk profile. So they get the feedback that, you know, you fall off the wagon, your body knows about it. That's what these numbers are telling you. Does this really work? Well, I'm going to show you. This is actually those were hypothetical profiles. This is real data now. I'm showing you the profile of a 66-year-old man whose wife stopped me on the street about, I don't know, must have been 6, 7 years ago, saying, you know, I've been begging my husband to come to the program and do something. You've got to get him involved. And I sort of knew them distantly and gave him a call. I don't normally call people. I don't believe you can drag people into a program. They're either interested or they're not interested. But I gave him a call and I said, you know, your wife asked me to call you and she's really worried. Now, it was an interesting story. He'd had a heart attack 10 years earlier. So in his 50s, he's had his first heart attack. He'd already had 2 bypass operations. They weren't going to do a third one. So his bypass operations were finished. Had a couple of stents put in. And now when he had a small stroke already. And here he was at 66, a couple of heart attacks, a couple of bypass operations, a small stroke, and he's having angina that's out of control. He's getting chest pain whenever he does something. And the doctors are playing with his drugs as much as they can, but frankly, you know, this is not looking good. Now, as you can see from his numbers, his cholesterol was actually pretty tightly treated with drugs, but his HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol, was still very low. We like to see that as high as possible. You look at those people in Georgia and Russia who live into their 90s and 100s, their HDL cholesterols are 2.5 or 3. You look at a marathon runner, their HDL cholesterol is 2, 2.5. You look at a guy like this with heart disease, despite all the drugs he's getting, and his HDL cholesterol is under 1. And we don't have great drugs to raise the HDL cholesterol. The things we know work are not smoking, exercising, and losing weight. His blood pressure was okay. And you can see here his body mass index of 33.6, an ideal body mass index is 25. So he's got some serious weight to lose here. He's currently is weighing in at 58 to 72 kilos, and I'm sorry, his ideal body weight is 58 to 72 kilos, and he's in at 97 kilos. So he's getting a message, he's got a real problem here. This is what happened. This is 10-10, that's October 10, 2004. We're into March of 2005, so we're only talking a few months. Medication haven't been changed. Look what's happened, though. His risk has dropped from 41% to 33%. His HDL cholesterol has increased about 10%. Not huge, but when you see a small increase in HDL after just a few months, this is very encouraging. His body mass index has dropped from 33.5 to 32. He lost basically 4 kilos. It's, you know, 9, 10 pounds. This is substantial. This is real. His blood pressure went from 140 over 75, which was adequate, but not ideal, to 114 over 84. That's the blood pressure of a 20-year-old. That's where you'd like to see someone's blood pressure if you want it to be perfect. And that he's done in 4 or 5 months. These are his numbers by December of 2006. So we're looking approximately 2 years down the road. His risk has gone 47%, 37%, 14%. Now, one of the things I should tell you, in the first 3 months, the angina went away. We've known this for years. Hippocrates, in fact, first recognized that the easiest way to make someone's angina go away was send them out to cut wood. If they cut enough wood, after weeks and weeks and weeks, their angina got better. I mean, there was also a risk they dropped dead of another heart attack, but that's another story. But his risk went from 47 to 37 to 14%. Look what happened. He lost weight. He went from 97 kilos to 84 kilos, so he's lost about 13 kilos. That's over close to 30 pounds of weight he's taken off and kept off over 2 years. Look what's happened to his good cholesterol, the HDL cholesterol, which I think is so important. It went from 0.93 to 1 to 1.5. He's getting up there. He's close to doubled his HDL cholesterol. We don't even have a drug that can do this if we wanted to prescribe something. And he's done it naturally just by exercising and losing weight. And that's it. That's all he's done. By the way, I should point out in the background while this was all going on, we were having to reduce some of his medication. This inevitably happens. People lose a little weight, start exercising, and all the blood pressure pills they were on in the past, they can't keep taking. They start having dizzy spells every time they stand up. Their blood pressure gets so low. So we're cutting back the blood pressure pills. Often diabetes as well. If we get to your diabetes early enough, in other words, you're just developing the diabetes or you've had it less than 2 years, if we get you to lose weight and exercise, in many cases, we can wean you off your diabetes medication. It's entirely possible your diabetes will come back 5, 7, 8, 10 years later. But there are people, well-known cases, we've seen this repeatedly, where we get them to lose weight, we get their exercise under control, and the diabetes goes away, and we just haven't seen it come back over 10, 15 years. And again, not having diabetes is huge. If there's something you can control in your life, diabetes is a great one to go after. Having diabetes increases your risk of a heart attack or stroke about approximately fivefold. It's actually even worse than cigarettes. And probably about as hard to control as cigarette smoking is. Cigarette smoking is terribly addictive, very hard to get people to stop. And unfortunately, diabetic patients, as a general rule, have great difficulty losing weight and exercising. To some extent, it's how they got the diabetes in the first place. You don't have to come to CHIP to do these things. CHIP has a website. You can do all this stuff for yourself on the web. It's free. There's no advertising. It's a piece of cake. Log in, either myhealthcheckup.com or www.chiprehab.com. I've got brochures here for you. You can do these risk profiles on yourself and track your progress over time. Take it to your doctor. Say, look, you know, my numbers aren't as good as they could be. I could be doing something here besides you prescribing me more medication. Show your doctor after time that your numbers have gotten better. Ask your physician to decrease your medication. You've done this with lifestyle. This is perfectly, perfectly reasonable. There's other things you can do. This isn't available yet, but it's going to be soon. And this is something I'm very, very excited about. This is an exercise challenge that's going to become part of the website shortly, where you form groups. This really picks up on social networking. You form groups on the internet or in real life, and you say, we're going to do a walking challenge. It could be walk around the island of Montreal. It could be walk across Canada. It could be walk around the world. And the group logs in their miles every day, or the number of steps they take, or the number of physical activities they do, and the computer tracks your progress around the route that you've decided to follow. Meanwhile, the other groups are doing the same thing, so you've got a race going on. Every step of the way, you can see, every day you can see how your group is doing compared to the other groups. You can see how much further ahead the five groups are in front of you versus the five groups in back of you. You can get reminders 7, 10 days. If you haven't logged into the website and put in any miles, the computer says to you, where have you been? What's wrong with you? And it's all done out there in virtual reality. It's fantastic. I haven't seen any research studies on this idea yet, but the idea of getting people to work together, I'm very keen about. And I'm dying for someone to do a project like this. I'm hopeful once we've got the kinks out of running this thing, we'll get the funding and actually do a clinical trial proving that this makes a difference. You can do this with exercise. You can do with food challenges. You know, you can have a thing where you just count up the number of fruits and vegetables you eat every day. And you can do this with weight reduction. There's all kinds of things you can track. One of the keys to changing lifestyle is tracking progress. It could be something as simple as keeping a food diary because you're trying to change the foods you eat, even though I'm not big on dietary issues, unless we're talking about weight loss. It can be tracking how much exercise you're doing. One of the simplest things you can do is go out and buy yourself a pedometer, count up the number of steps you're taking every day. Ideally, you'd like to do about 10,000 steps a day, which is about 5 miles. But even if you're only doing 2,000 or 3,000 steps, just add 500 steps a week for a few weeks. Add a few extra thousand steps to your daily routine. You could be knocking off half a pound of weight that way without even changing your diet. Tracking weight, of course, is critical. There's no point in going on a weight loss program if you never check your weight. At least once a week, I think it's reasonable to know how your weight's doing, or at least what your abdominal circumference looks like. You may not lose weight if you're exercising a lot and putting on a little bit of muscle, but you should see the body shape changing. You should see your waist getting a little bit smaller. So this idea of tracking things, I think it's the future. You're going to see a lot of this. One day it won't even be something you'll do on computer. It'll be something you'll be doing with your telephone. You know, you'll be tracking your progress on your phone. So just to quickly summarize in terms of cardiovascular disease, what are the benefits of exercise? Well, it improves blood lipids. It increases the HDL cholesterol. It lowers the bad cholesterol, the LDL. It decreases blood pressure. It decreases blood pressure by about 6 to 7 millimeters of mercury, which is about the equivalent of one antihypertensive medication. So exercising regularly is like taking an antihypertensive drug. And most of us, if we're on antihypertensive drugs, can't keep our blood pressure treated with just one anyways, where most of us are on 2 or 3. Regular exercise also increases insulin sensitivity. So the way your body responds to the insulin that your pancreas turns out is very important. It reduces the likelihood that you're going to have to go on to using either medication, oral pills, or insulin to control your blood glucose because you've developed diabetes. And it's been proven in some big, big studies all over the world, at least 3 major big studies, that have shown that if you're at risk for diabetes because you have a family history of diabetes or your sugar's already in that borderline range, exercising, losing 10, 15 pounds reduces your risk of diabetes over the next 3 to 5 years by 60%. That's huge. And again, not developing diabetes is worth something, but you got to get to it early. By the time you've been on medication for 2 to 3 years, while you can still use exercise to bring your blood sugar down, it's very difficult to actually make the diabetes go away at that point. Pancreas just tires, and it just can't keep up any longer, and then you're pretty much stuck on the meds for life. And you should take them. They're still important. And I've mentioned it prevents diabetes as well. So you say to me, all right, well, what if my overall cardiovascular risk is low? I did my risk profile. It looks terrific. I don't have to do this. I'm off the hook. Are there any other additional benefits of a heart healthy lifestyle? And this is where exercise is so potentially powerful, not just because of what it does to your blood pressure, your blood sugar, your blood cholesterol, because of all the things it does for other common conditions that we're currently spending a fortune on. Physical activity and mental health. Stress. Physical activity protects against stress, It protects against depression. There's 35 million days lost per year due to mental disorders in our society, and it's probably a huge underestimate because it's underreported. Sedentary Canadians have a 60% increased risk of depression compared to active Canadians. If you have depression, if you've been treated for depression, here's a wonderful study by Babiak and company in 2000 where they compared half the group got the typical antidepressant medication we use, SSRIs, drugs like Prozac, Zoloft, and the other group didn't get the medication. They just got an exercise program. And I'm not talking about mild depression, I'm talking about major depression in this study. As you can see, at 10 months follow-up, 88% of those individuals who were exercising had recovered completely, compared to only 56% who had recovered completely on the medication. Exercise trumped the medication. Now, I'm not telling anybody who's taking antidepressants to throw your antidepressants down the toilet and run out and start walking. I'm not suggesting that at all. But if you're on medication for depression, to not be exercising regularly is a terrible, terrible mistake. Not only does it help treat the depression, it helps prevent relapse. If you know people who are being treated for mild or moderate depression and they haven't given exercise a try as part of their treatment, they're being suboptimally treated. So never miss out on that opportunity. Insomnia. Exercise has a positive impact on sleep habits. Now, this is an area that's become particularly interesting to me. We've got a big randomized clinical trial and application to the Canadian Institute for Health Research right now over the next 5 years to do an exercise trial for insomnia. If you look at the data in Quebec, for those of you who are in the 55, 60-year-old range and over, insomnia is present, serious insomnia is common among 30 to 40% of people. It's extraordinary when you look at the numbers, how many people are unhappy about the sleep they had the night before. There's good data, clinical trial data. They took a group of patients, they put them in a gym class 3 times a week, the other group were told to stretch, and they showed the people who went to the gym class after 3 months, they took less time to fall asleep, 15 minutes compared to 28 minutes, and they slept significantly longer, an additional 42 minutes per night on average. This stuff works. Again, if you're taking sleeping pills on a regular basis and you're not using exercise as part of your insomnia treatment, this is suboptimal. Leisure time physical activity at midlife and the risk of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Now, I'll be honest with you, we don't have a clinical trial here where they took half a group who, you know, and half of them were told to stretch and the other half were put on an exercise program, and they showed 15 years later there was less Alzheimer's disease. We haven't got that level of evidence yet. But if you look at the clinical epidemiologic data, if you look at people who do exercise and people who don't exercise, this was a patient, they say randomly selected, but they mean they just took a subsample of people who were in a large population survey, and in this particular case, 1,449 people, and they looked at who developed the dementia and who developed the Alzheimer's disease. Leisure time physical activity at midlife, at least 2 times a week, was associated with a reduced risk of dementia, 48% reduction in the probability to develop dementia, and a 38% reduction in the probability to develop Alzheimer's disease. Again, we have no medications out there that can... I can't prove to you, I'm not convinced we'll see 48 and 38% reductions. But think about the physiology for a moment. We know that a substantial portion of the dementia we see is not some fancy Alzheimer's diagnosis. It's really vascular dementia. It's inadequate blood supply to the brain, either that's resulted in strokes or little tiny mini strokes that nobody's ever detected. But when you go and you do a scan of these people's brains, the brain has shrunk, the ventricles have widened, there's just less brain there. It hasn't been getting fed as well as somebody who's in good shape. And it's not surprising. These are people, when you put them through cognitive testing, whose memory scores aren't as good, whose ability to carry out complex activities aren't as good, who are starting to see they're having a struggle together. Now, we're all losing our brains to some extent, and there's nothing much you can do about it. But from all the available data that's available right now, to not exercise could be one of the stupidest things you could do. If you look at anything that potentially will delay the onset of cognitive decline, the two big ones are don't smoke and exercise regularly. Who needs an exercise stress test? Let's say you're thinking about exercise and you're saying, well, you know, what if I get out there and I exercise and I have a massive heart attack or stroke just because I started exercising? Well, there actually is a small risk for some people, but it's actually very few people. Anyone who's got cardiovascular disease or diabetes should have a stress test before they start exercising, just to make sure that they don't have subclinical cardiovascular disease that's going to become a problem when they start exercising without anybody supervising them. And moderately high-risk people, if you get onto that website and you do a risk profile on yourself and you see that your risk is over 10% over the next 10 years of having a cardiovascular event, it wouldn't be imprudent to get a stress test done either at your hospital or one of the private stress labs in the city just before you start exercising. What you're looking for is any evidence that when you stress the heart, that there's any evidence of inadequate blood flow. Because if that's the case, you'd like to do something about it before you precipitate a problem because you've decided you're going to get in shape. That's for high-intensity exercise. For moderate-intensity exercise, again, people with cardiovascular disease or diabetes should get this done. And people whose risk is over 20%, I mean really high risk, if you're talking about just walking. But you know, the good news is you can go and walk leisurely 30 minutes every day and you don't need a stress test, because the chance that you're going to really significant, if you develop any discomfort, either shortness of breath or chest pain from just casual walking, you've got a problem that should be checked out by a doctor. But as long as you're asymptomatic, as long as your breathing is fine and you don't have any chest pain, no lightheadedness, and you're not stressing yourself too much, you don't even have to do a stress test. What about a heart healthy diet? I'm going to go through this quickly because I could spend hours on this. I'm sorry to tell you. I mean, this is sort of a good news, bad news story. The bad news is there's very little evidence that there's virtually no evidence that reduced saturated fat will really reduce your likelihood of developing heart disease. This is one of the great scams that came out of the United States over the last 40 years. Antioxidants have clearly been proven to be ineffective. Garlic supplements, there was never much there. Ginkgo biloba, forget it. Increased omega-3 fatty acids, eating fatty fish oil, rapeseed oil, probably looks like about the most promising thing that's out there at the moment. But I'm sorry to say, given our history with finding dietary solutions to prevent heart disease, I wouldn't bet the farm on it just yet. So the bad news is there doesn't seem to be any magical cure in terms of your diet. On the other side of the coin, the good news is you probably can eat just about anything you want in moderation. As long as you keep your weight under control. And again, I use the word moderation. Nobody should live at Schwartz's, 7 days a week. But not to go there once in a while, why not? If you're out at dinner, this is Montreal, and, you know, dessert looks terrific. How can you not have some? It's crazy. Just crazy. So, I mean, the good news is there's nothing you have to exclude from your diet. I mean, don't ever forget the fact that eating is more than just about providing nutrients to your body. It's also about pleasure. It's about socializing. It's about having a good time and enjoying life. And the good news is you can do it as long as you keep your weight under control and you exercise regularly. For those of you who'd like to know more about this whole diet, saturated fat business, it's a whole lecture. I'd be happy to give it to you, but you've got to invite me back for that. But if you want to get into it real quickly, there's two things I'm going to propose to you. One is this article by John Turney in the New York Times from October 9th, 2007. It was called Diet and Fat, a Severe Case of Mistaken Consensus. In 1988, the Surgeon General, Everett Koop, proclaimed ice cream to be a public health menace right up there with cigarettes. This is unbelievable. Dr. Koop announced that the American diet was a problem of comparable magnitude, chiefly because of high-fat foods that were causing coronary heart disease and other deadly ailments. He introduced his report with the words, "The depth of the science base underlying the findings is even more impressive than that for tobacco and health in 1964. It's just not true. This was a ludicrous statement, and Gary Tobe, this is the other reference I'm going to give you, wrote a wonderful book that's well worth reading. It's a good science detective story about the politics of science and how did the Americans get so far off track and how did they drag us down into this quagmire of fat. You know, the fat in your food is the fat in your blood vessels. It's called Good Calories, Bad Calories. It was published in 2007. Terrific read. He's a very good writer. And to the best of my knowledge, all the facts he talks about in there are absolutely true. The notion that fatty foods shorten your life began as a hypothesis based on dubious assumptions and data. You know, some of the data where they took rabbits who don't eat any fat in their diet. You know, they eat lettuce. And they put them on high-fat diets. And they showed that they developed fatty streaks in their blood vessels. And they said, see? Fat's terrible for rabbits' blood vessels. But people are carnivores. We've been eating, we've been eating meat. That's what the teeth are all about. I mean, this is nothing new. That was the type of evidence they had. And when they came up with evidence that didn't support their conclusions, their conclusion being that the fat in the diet's causing all this, They suppressed it. Academic lives and careers were destroyed because people came up with information that went against the conventional wisdom. One of the best stories that you'll find in this book that I love is they're talking about Peter Ahrens, the lipid physiologist in the United States, comes before a commission that Senator McGovern is running on the diet in America. And he's trying to tell the senators that, you know, he doesn't think where they're going with this, with the saturated fat business, is supported by the science. And Senator McGovern says to him, do you know that we have a polling where 92% of the 100 best-known doctors in the world agree with the hypothesis that fat in the diet causes fat in the blood vessels? And Dr. Ahrens replied, you know, Senator, the vast majority of doctors in our society know very little about diet and cardiovascular disease. I've spent my entire life working in this area. The healthcare policies that you're about to start promoting and push on our society are going to have huge implications for the food industry, for the way we eat, for obesity, the way we feed our children. And I just don't think those sorts of decisions should be made because 92% of doctors in some poll reached a consensus about an issue they know very little about. And that's the reality of science today. Nothing's changed. The evidence against Haagen-Dazs is nothing like the evidence against Marlboros. One thing I can absolutely assure you, having a bowl of Haagen-Dazs every day will just not take 3 to 5 years off your life the way the cigarettes will. And I'm going to pretty much finish off there with this slide, with the lifeguard whistling at the kid who's walking from the cafeteria with his ice cream and sauce and his cherry on top. I can tell you, I eat a hot fudge sundae on a regular basis, every 2-3 days. The reason I do that, my sister happens to make the best hot fudge sauce in the world, and she constantly feeds me this stuff. And I love ice cream. I exercise regularly to try and work off all the hot fudge sauce and ice cream, but it's very satisfying. There's nothing that, you know, sort of brings your stress down at the end of the day like a hot fudge sundae. I can't help you on the hot fudge sauce. My sister only makes enough for me. You'll have to go find your own. But I can tell you, this stuff is terrific. And if you have a favorite food that you enjoy eating and you can keep your weight under control, I just don't care what's there. That's the key. So the take-home message is a prudent lifestyle in terms of your diet, absolutely exercising regularly, absolutely no smoking, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts on that one. And do the best you can, recognizing that we're all human. It's extremely difficult to follow all these recommendations to the letter of the law. Don't beat yourself up just because you've had a momentary lapse. Get back on the wagon and give it another try. And I'll stop there. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
So Dr. Grove is willing to take your questions. If you could just wait until the mic gets to you, because we'd like to make sure that the webcast picks up on the answers, the questions and answers. We have a few minutes.
Although they may not know the details, most people instinctively know that healthy lifestyle is important in terms of exercise and food. Yet the vast majority of the people don't follow it. So what has research shown that works in encouraging people to do it, other than telling them that they ought to do it and that it's all the benefits? Since that approach doesn't seem to be very successful, has there been any research about programs that actually overcome people's inertia?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We know that incentives work to a point, but they're not a panacea. More and more there's interest in wellness in the workplace, because that's where people spend the majority of their time, you know, certainly working age people. You know, if they're spending 8 hours a day at their job, the idea of focusing the wellness programs in the workplace is very, very attractive. And companies are, particularly in the States, much more than here in Canada, because in the States they bear all the burden of their health care costs, whereas here, you know, publicly funded health care assumes most of it. In the States they're very, very interested in this, but we're starting to see this happen in Canada too. There is some data proving that if you give employees incentives, such as cash bonuses for stopping smoking or exercising regularly or losing some weight, they'll do it. They're more likely to do it. If you give them disincentives, like higher premiums on their health insurance coverage, their health benefits, they're more likely to do it. So incentives, disincentives, all the things that change behavior help, but they help a little, not a lot. At the end of the day, you're talking about the inertia that's just our human nature against all the other things that are vying for our time and attention. And there's no question in today's society, the two biggest ones, of course, are television and the internet. You know, our life has moved into the realm of virtual living. You theoretically could spend your entire life lying there in bed with a computer on your lap. With that video screen and that keyboard, you could just about do everything. You could have food delivered to your house. You can take care of your banking. As long as you have to get it, you could earn a living. I mean, there's all kinds of people that never leave their computer and earn a living. These are huge, huge challenges, not only for adults, but particularly for children, because there's a whole generation of kids coming down the pike here who are just spending extraordinary number of hours in front of one screen or another. So these are real challenges, and there is no simple answer, and you're absolutely right. When you try and look at, the government spends a huge amount of money on research every year trying to find that magic bullet that's going to make people change their lifestyle. Probably the things that seem to work best in terms of long-term maintenance is make small changes, be realistic in your goals. Don't say, I'm going to lose 50 pounds. That's just craziness. Go for 10. When you get to the 10 and you keep it for 6 months, take it the next step. Don't try and lose weight, stop smoking, and start exercising all simultaneously. That's a real recipe for failure. The average individual, when he stops smoking, is going to gain weight, and he's got to be prepared for it. So little steps and recognizing that these are huge challenges, it really isn't very easy.
It's on. Hello?
Hi.
I fall off the wagon on a regular basis with chocolate cheesecake and all kinds of stuff. So I particularly liked your advice, and I want to know if you take new patients.
Yeah.
No, just kidding. The real question is that, was that slide you showed before about the triple bypass hamburger for real? Like, is that a real menu item?
Real. That's a real menu item. That's a real restaurant.
A real restaurant.
I think it underscores how there's so much misunderstanding out there and people are so frustrated with the stuff that somebody's actually making a living selling bypass surgery in the way of, huge amounts of overeating, if you will. And it sells.
You mentioned earlier in your talk about joining a gym club and getting exercise there. How about incorporating exercise in your everyday work? I cycled here. I walked to work 35 minutes. Even when I use my car to go to a shopping center, I'll park at the far end of the shopping center and walk across the shopping center to the store. And that's even faster because you'll see lots of people driving around for 10 minutes trying to find the closest parking spot. I see my neighbor drive one block to go to the dépanneur.
You're absolutely right. I couldn't put it better. I mean, that's exactly the sort of advice that we give people. one of the joys of living in Montreal is the distances are relatively short. Most of us do not spend our lives on the freeway, getting to and from home, work, et cetera, et cetera. Walking is very doable, even in the worst of winter. Quite frankly, even when things are terrible on the roads, you can probably get where you're trying to go faster on foot than you can in the traffic. There's no substitute for walking. And if you can incorporate that into your day, you largely have taken care of your exercise equivalent, if you will. And I do exactly like you do. I rarely drive the car. I'm lucky enough that, I don't live that far from McGill, and the various research labs and hospitals I work in are all, nothing is more than 20 or 30 minutes away by foot. And there's no nicer way to give yourself a bit of a respite during the day than to spend that 20, 30 minutes walking to wherever it is you're going rather than sitting there in traffic and fighting over a parking spot and all the other stuff.
And walking home from work after a stressful day, please.
This is therapeutic. This is absolutely therapeutic. I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you.
Hi. I have a question about your diet recommendations. You mentioned basically the food items. How about drinks such as coffee? Is it good to the heart or not? Because I'm a coffee lover, and I think I wouldn't like to get rid of it. But, I have read a lot of conflicting views about, the benefit or bad, side effects of the coffee drinking. So
I've never seen any convincing data that coffee in moderation is any problem whatsoever. And by moderation, I mean a few cups of coffee a day, providing you can sleep at night, The number of studies I've seen published in the best journals, you know, New England Medical Journal even, on coffee and pancreatic cancer and coffee and, I mean, the list just goes on and on. I've never seen a beverage so misaligned. The things that really worry me are beverages that are filled with sugar. So sugar, you know, sweetened soft drinks, that's a huge problem, particularly in the portion sizes that they're served now. Quite frankly, fruit juices, as counterintuitive as this may sound, when people tell you they're drinking 3 glasses of juice a day, right away a red flag goes up. That stuff, unfortunately, is just filled with about the same amount of sugar as the soft drinks are. It's got other nutrients in it, there's no question. But frankly, if you're in the mood for a glass of apple, just go eat an apple. Get the fiber. It doesn't raise your blood sugar as much. And you won't feel feel fuller after the apple than you will after that glass of apple juice. So I stay away from fruit juices, too, as a general rule. It's not that they're not, I mean, you know, a fresh glass of orange juice in the morning, if someone's willing to make it for you, I think is wonderful. but there's nobody at my house that'll do that.
We were talking about society's inertia and lack of incentives. I was just wondering, with the government who spent so much money on research, and also for Medicare, and also private insurances who are willing to cover these huge expenses on drugs, why aren't they doing anything about getting people to move if it's a question of cost? I mean, maybe they should be refocus on getting people healthier instead of treating them. Is that something that's being done at all in society, or are there any initiatives that have been?
Very little. The only one that really comes to mind is the Harper government in the last couple of years gave us a tax rebate on sending our, $500 per child to get them into some sort of physical activity. But to be quite frank with you, that rebate should be available to anybody of any age at the very minimum. I'm not a politician, so I can't give you an answer that I'm absolutely certain of, but my gut feeling about this is prevention just doesn't make a lot of political sense. Because as a politician, you're looking at having to spend the money up front for benefits that will occur long after you're out of office. So someone else is going to get the benefits while you have to somehow sell the costs. And frankly, given the problems that our healthcare system are in, it's much easier to win votes because you keep someone's hospital open, or you keep access to medication for free, or you do something about the shortage of doctors and nurses and technicians in a community. That's the sort of thing people can see immediate results. And I think the politicians also have a high, reasonable skepticism. They think to themselves, we can throw a lot of money at this, but what's the chance we can actually change behavior? Their caution is well-meaning in some respects, but there's got to be strategies when you think of the money we're throwing away on healthcare. There's got to be some more we can do. Quebec, by the way, is one of the very few jurisdictions in Canada where we do not have publicly funded cardiac rehabilitation for people who've already had a heart attack. If you have a heart attack in Ottawa, Toronto, Vancouver, you go immediately to a rehab program. It's all paid for 6 months by the government. Quebec, there's nothing that's paid for. This is shameful.
I'm still digesting that wonderful comment about it doesn't matter what kind of food you eat as long as it, is at a level that will help you maintain a healthy weight. So hypothetically, if I had a big salad every day and a couple of fried bananas and just to within the prescribed amount of room in my diet, maybe a small piece of steak, some French fries, maybe a little thimbleful of ice cream if there was still room within that. Surely there are other guidelines in terms of fried foods, in terms of red meats. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There's lots of guidelines. Look, the Canadian food guidelines come out and get revised every, 5-6 years. They'll give you, there's a huge food pyramid. The list of stuff you could read about is huge. I just think most of it, while it's reasonable common sense stuff, if you take it to the letter, most of it's a waste of time fussing to that degree. I think, you've got to be careful. I wasn't suggesting that you just keep your weight under control. I also mentioned a prudent diet where you eat anything you want in moderation, which means There should be no single item that completely dominates your diet. There should be plenty of fruits and vegetables. There should be some grains. There should be some, as long as you're, if you're a vegetarian, that's fine with me, but there's nothing wrong with having some meat. Nothing wrong with having dairy products. Nothing wrong with having that ice cream, even every day if you want, to be quite frank with you. I mean, what's ice cream really other than some dairy fat and a little bit of sugar? Okay, you throw the hot fudge sauce on it. It's a bit more of a problem, but I don't use a lot of hot fudge, just a little. And it's great stuff.
Yes, you touched on saturated fats, and I was just wondering, at one point we were all told to look for monounsaturated and polyunsaturated. Does that still hold true, or?
You know, we're slowly letting that one go. For years, we couldn't get the lipid guidelines, you know, the updated cholesterol guidelines in Canada, 1 year got held up indefinitely because the nutrition organizations didn't feel there was enough emphasis on this polyunsaturated. You know, the data just doesn't play out. When you modify the amount of fat in the diet that way, and you look at what happens to people's cholesterols, it doesn't seem to make a difference, unfortunately. So I don't fuss myself about that. Again, my, you know, prudent diet, everything in moderation, keep your weight under control. I don't care what you're eating.
You mentioned that working, using or incorporating exercise into your daily routine, like walking to work, is sufficient. Isn't there an issue about exercise intensity as well? Because I know there's some controversy about that.
That's a very good point. I absolutely agree with you. It depends on what you're trying to do. Ideally, if your cholesterol, your blood pressure, your blood sugar, everything's perfect, many of the benefits around osteoporosis, depression, and just feeling healthy can actually be achieved by just being on your feet a substantial portion of the day. You know, that 30 minutes of brisk walking. Ideally, I'd like you to get your heart running a little bit, but it's amazing what you can accomplish with just the walking. If, however, you want to lower your blood pressure, you want to lower your blood sugar, you want to lower your cholesterol, it looks like you have to do much more intensive exercise. And I tell people, how intense? Well, it's exercise that's either 65 to 85% of your maximum heart rate. You can figure out what your maximum heart rate is by taking 220 minus your age. And 65, so if 220 minus your age is 150, and you then take 65 to 85% of 150, that's your target zone. If you're on medication or you have heart disease, don't use that algorithm. Go get a stress test and let the doctor who does the stress test tell you what your target zone is. But getting yourself up into that zone actually gives you more health benefits than just the walking. And as a general rule of thumb, we tell people, well, how do you know when you're up in that zone? Well, as a general rule, you should be able to talk comfortably, but you shouldn't be able to sing. If you can sing, you're not going fast enough. If you can't talk, you're going too fast. I also tell patients, at the end of a good workout, an aerobic workout, you should feel like taking a shower. And then you know you're in the zone.
Hi. I find that I guess most people don't listen to their body enough, because your body will tell you if you overeat, you don't feel well. If you drink too much coffee, you know, you might get heart palpitations. So, but in my personal experience, I find that people just don't listen enough. I mean, it's not just the shell. You have to, you know, take care of it. And if you listen to it and just... It'll tell you, you know, you need to go out there and exercise, or just stop doing this. This is a little bit too much. So I don't know if anybody else feels the same.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, if your body hurts, it's trying to tell you something. If you're not sleeping well, it's trying to tell you something. If you're feeling depressed or stressed out, it's trying to tell you something. All of those things are important messages.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berman. We'll have some of these pamphlets about the CHIP organization and the website, and I'd encourage you all to go and visit the website. There's a wealth of information available there, too, and you're welcome to join us for some refreshments, and I hope you can stick around for a few minutes.